But this morning, we are actually going to be taking a look at a really complex topic of forgiveness. And so I want you to just take a minute and think through, like, when you were a child and, like, the first time that you had a lesson on forgiveness, either where you had to ask for it or where you had to receive it. For me, I was a kid that chewed on a lot of stuff. I actually have home videos of myself when I'm about, like, I don't know, 6 months old, chewing on a bottle of Desitin and my mom being like, no! And so that kind of tradition of chewing things in my mouth carried on over till about first grade. So I remember chewing on the strap of my sister's purse and leaving some bite marks in it. And she was telling me, you know, if you chew on that again, I'm going to pull it out of your mouth. And sure enough, I chewed on it, and she yanked it out, and I lost a tooth. Well, about a week later, I had deja vu because I was chewing on her toy unicorn, and she yanked that thing out of my mouth, and there went another tooth. And to this day, I don't understand why I had to apologize. I lost two teeth, you know, and yet I had to apologize. And so as an adult, I start to look at forgiveness a little differently, and hopefully you guys do too. And so this is a story from a couple weeks ago where I'm home with my kids, and I'm a tasker, so I'm constantly doing things. I have difficulty sitting and resting, and so I start cleaning my house, and I get it exactly how I want it on the inside, and then I've got still like half a day left. I'm like, oh. So I start looking around, and I look at the patio, and there's this playhouse in my front yard that I've been wanting to move to our side yard. You know exactly what I'm talking about. I ran into the Johnsons after this happened. It's so good. Okay, so I have this playhouse, and I'm like, I'm going to move that thing. Okay, 70 pounds playhouse. So today's the day. I'm going to move that thing. So my husband's not home, and I probably should have his help for this. In fact, I think I asked a couple times, and he said, yeah, I'll help you, just, you know, not right now. And so I start to move this 70-pound house, and I bring over, oh, that's my family right there, yep. Okay, so here's the house, okay? I'm moving that. So I put this house on a wagon. Do you have a picture of the wagon? Oh, on that wagon, okay? So I take off the sides of that wagon. So I load, I'm like lifting this house like this, okay? Putting it on this wagon, okay? And then I start wheeling it around the block because my house has an alley, so you can't just get around. So I'm wheeling this thing around the block. I've got neighbors that are like, what is she doing, right? So I get it to the back of the house. I lift it up like this, okay? And I start to bring it through the fence gap, right? And I try to bring it through the gate. Only I'm about 2 inches, you know, too snug in there. So I'm like, after a while of trying, I bring this house down, I set it down. My upper thighs are definitely bruised now, right? And I'm just starting to get hot and mad, okay? So I'm hot and my kids are watching me. I've got neighbors kind of spectating, like, what's going on here? And I decide, okay, fine, I'm going to take this thing apart. So I get the drill, and drill by drill, I start taking every screw out, okay? Over 200 screws in this thing, okay? So now I have a pile of wood and a pile of screws, and my kids are looking at me wide-eyed and just waiting of what's going to happen. And I bring each piece back into the side yard, and I move each piece. And then I say, okay, I'm going to rebuild it now. So I start to drill in, and it just falls. Can't put it back together. I start drilling new holes, the wood splits. The whole thing is firewood now. So you can see how it just irked me, right? So I'm sitting there and I'm moving my mouth and words aren't coming out. Right? And my kids are like, well, what's wrong? And I'm like, it's broken. It's just broken. It's just broken. Okay? So we go inside the house, and, you know, naturally, what do I do? Well, whose fault is it? It's my husband's fault. So it must be his fault, right? So we have a text message conversation. It goes something like this. I moved the kids' playhouse. He says, nice. I broke it. This is all your fault. And he says, I'm confused. Well, what's confusing? The house is now firewood, and it's your fault. And he says, I'm not even there. How is this my fault again. It just is. Okay? So I'm even more upset at this point. My kids ask me what's wrong, and I say, well, Dad didn't help me. And so as I'm putting my kid to sleep tonight, and they want to call their dad to say goodnight, Selah calls her dad, and she says, Dad, how come you don't want to help Mom? And suddenly, I can see the ripple effect that my sin has around me. And so I'm a three-day processor. It takes me about 3 days to acknowledge that I've done something wrong, let alone admit it. Some of you know this already. And so on the third day, I call my husband, and I tell him I'm sorry. And I ask for him to forgive me. He says, of course I forgive you. And then that night, I had to sit with my children, and I had to ask them for forgiveness. And so forgiveness is not always easy to extend, and it's not always easy to receive. And so as we look at this morning, I really want to encourage you to bring whatever you're carrying, whatever kind of offenses that you're carrying from people, bring those to Jesus this morning. We're in a series of looking at the life of Jesus, and today we're going to be unpacking the parable of the unmerciful servant. And so if you'd like to follow along, you can find that in Matthew chapter 18. It's verse 21 through 35. So Jesus was communicating to Peter about sin when he approached Jesus with the following question. Lord, how many times should I forgive my brother or sister who has sinned against me? Up to seven times? Knowing Peter, he was likely looking for Jesus to say, ah, attaboy, seven times is good. Besides, that seems pretty generous. And if you can show that level of forgiveness, you're probably a pretty nice person, probably a pretty good person. In the Jewish norm, forgiving someone an offense up to three times was acceptable and seemed righteous. So you can imagine Peter's surprise when his verse in verse 22, it says, I tell you not seven times, but up to 77 times. And Jesus follows this up with an excessive expectation of forgiveness with the parable of the unmerciful servant. And so picking up in verse 23, he says, therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servant. Now, the king being God, and the servant being us, humanity. And as he began a settlement, a man who owed him 10,000 bags of gold was brought to him. Now, I want you to think about how much this man owes. 10,000 bags of gold in Jewish culture is roughly $10 million in U.S. Okay? So that's how much this servant owes. This is a huge amount of money for anyone, okay? And so, let alone for a servant, to think a servant would owe this much, okay? To put it in more perspective, the average American has about $5,600 in credit card debt. So this parable, this servant had somehow accrued 200 times the average amount of debt. It's a lot of debt. Jesus is making this story almost an exaggeration to communicate something to us. We need to pay attention to that. And so since the servant was not able to pay, the master ordered that he and his wife and his children and all that he had be sold to repay the debt. Verse 26, at this, the servant fell to his knees and begged. And so the posture of falling to your knees is important because it communicates and demonstrates humility. It says, I am at the mercy of another. The servant goes on to beg, he says, be patient with me, and I will pay back everything. And the servant's master took pity on him and canceled all of his debt and let him go. For whatever reason, the servant owes the king a debt he cannot repay. And keeping with the customs, the king had the power and the right to sell off the servant and his family and all of his belongings to recoup some of his losses. And instead, the servant, or the king, forgives his debt in full. Now we get to examine the servant's response to this act of mercy and generosity, picking up at verse 28. But when the servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 silver coins. Now that's about 20 bucks, okay? That's about 4 tall Starbucks white mochas, okay? Not that I would know. 20 bucks, okay? Verse 28, he grabbed him and began to choke him. Pay back what you owe me, he demanded. His fellow servant fell to his knees and began to beg. Same posture as the first servant. Be patient with me, and I will pay it back. This is the same exact response that the first servant had with the king. Mind you, we're talking about 20 bucks now, okay? Not 10 million. Verse 30, but he refused. Instead, he went off and had the man thrown into prison until he could pay his debt. When the other servants saw what had happened, they were outraged, and they went to their master and told him everything that had happened. Now, plagued by short-term memory, the servant goes out and found another servant that owed him roughly a day's wages. Instantly, he physically assaults the guy and demands that he repays him for what he owes. Now, for the sake of not getting confused, I'm going to go ahead and call servant number one Bob and servant number two John. Sorry if your name is Bob or John or Bob Johns, okay? So, John asked Bob for time to repay what he owes. The irony here is that with some time, John may actually be able to repay Bob. But when Bob made the same request to the king, there was no way he could ever repay that debt that he owed. So uncharitable Bob has John thrown into prison until he can repay his debt. Now, how is a servant supposed to pay or earn money while he's in prison? We don't make any wages in prison. So you can imagine the king's fury when he receives reports back that the servant he showed mercy to had quickly forgotten and chose not to extend that same generosity to someone else. So let's read how the king responds to Mr. Bob, picking back up in verse 32. Then the master called in the servant and he said, "You wicked servant, I canceled all that debt because you begged me to do so. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you?" In anger, his master handed him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should be able to pay back what he owed. "This is how my heavenly Father will treat you, unless you forgive your brother or your sister from your heart." So parables can be a bit confusing and a mystery at times. And so I want to be very clear that Christ has forgiven you. He's offered forgiveness to you in full already, and nothing can take that away. Okay? So the end of this passage makes me sit with curiosity. And I can't help but wonder if God is saying here is the best way to live your life. Forgive as you have been forgiven. And when you choose not to abide in the way of the Father, you actually put yourself in a form of bondage, okay? You separate yourself from the way, and you disregard the love that God has lavished upon us. Just a thought. So truly, here's where we get the thrust of this parable. Jesus wants Peter to understand the unconditionality of forgiveness. Romans 8:39, nothing can separate us from the love of Christ, right? As receivers of mercy, we are to be dispensers of enormous quantities of grace. Peter wanted to make a rule of forgiveness by asking Jesus, "What's the maximum amount of times I should have to do this?" And he was missing the point of grace. When we fully understand that we've been forgiven much, we're not tempted to keep that mental spreadsheet of all the times we've had to give forgiveness. Freely you have received, and freely you give. And forgiveness doesn't always come natural to us. So let's put ourselves in this story for a minute. We're the first servant. We owe a debt that we cannot pay. We're at the feet of the king, and we are begging, right? We are begging this guy's mercy. And then he forgives us. He forgives all that debt that we owe. Now, what on earth would cause us to go out and demand that someone repay us, right? And withhold forgiveness? So a few suggestions would be maybe power. Maybe we've been bullied and maybe we've been bossed around and this is our chance to power up and it feels good to have some power. Or pride. Maybe we look at this situation with the king as luck, right? Well, I got away with it once, you know. If I find myself in that situation again, I'll just get away with it again, right? Maybe we're calloused. This might not be the first time that the servant owes us money. And so over time, we just feel like we've been taken advantage of. And so we start to put up self-protectors and we say, well, I'm gonna put a stop to this, right? Forgetfulness, we can get distracted. We move so quickly on to the next thing that we forget those moments of grace that have been shown to us, right? We experience it in our head, but we don't allow it to even touch our heart. There are countless reasons why we withhold forgiveness, and none of them lead to a fuller life. And think about who we withhold forgiveness from the most. Our families, right? Spouses, coworkers, friends. It's the people that we do the most amount of life with, so it makes sense that we'd have the most amount of conflict with them. God knows what our ordinary looks like, and he wants to do something extraordinary within our relationships with the people that we do life with. We've been affected by brokenness within humanity, and we've been deceived and lied to. We've been fooled and forgotten. We've not been handled with care in crisis and heartbreak. We've been abused and betrayed, and we bear wounds upon our hearts inflicted by others. We put up walls, we keep tally, and we justify all the reasons we have to be angry with someone else. We've had all this done onto us, and we have done all this onto others. The demands of forgiveness feel weighty and almost humanly impossible at times. And there's a raw reality here that you might actually extend the olive branch to somebody and they may take that and just snap it right in front of you, right? You may find yourself being vulnerable and someone uses that stance of humility to fuel their own power and their self-importance. Forgiveness does not necessarily yield a healed circumstance or relationship. Forgiveness is a one-sided responsibility between you and God. It's a personal responsibility. So you do your part. It is not your job to worry about the response of the other person. Okay? Romans 12:18 says, if it is possible, as far as it depends on you, be at peace with everyone. Okay? I think Brennan Manning's words from Abba's Child here are incredibly helpful. Only reckless confidence in a source greater than ourselves can empower us to forgive the wounds inflicted by others. In boundary moments such as these, there is only one place to go. That's Calvary. I have found that when I'm able to forgive someone and be released from anger and resentment, that forgiveness didn't stand alone. The life of Jesus points us to this intimate connection between compassion and forgiveness. And so what is compassion, right? So Webster says it's a noun. It's sympathetic pity and concern for the suffering or the misfortune of others. Now, I disagree. I don't think it's a noun. I think it's very much a verb. Because when I look at the life of Jesus, I see his compassion in action, okay? Not only does he feel deeply for the one that suffers, but he also suffers alongside them. It's one thing to feel sadness and sorrow for another, but it's another to take on the load of another and wear their pain with them. That's different. And so that's a completely different way of doing life, and yet it's the way that Christ shows us. Compassion, if I were to give a different definition, is the disposition that fuels us into acts of kindness and mercy. Compassion comes at a righteous cost to those who brave such an action. So I want to tell you guys a story about this past May with my daughter. during the month of May, we were driving down Monta Vista, and we would see this man standing on the corner holding a sign. And we drive past that thing, that intersection a couple times, and this man would be standing there, and my kids would ask questions. What's he doing? Why is he there? What does his sign say? And so I would do my best to explain that situation to my kids, as best I could to a 3- and a 6-year-old. And I would read his sign, and I would say, well, his sign says that he's hungry. And my daughter would think about that. She didn't respond. She would just, okay. Well, we have a tradition in our family of taking our kids out for a donut on their birthday. So my daughter's birthday is on June 1st. And so I asked my daughter, as we're getting close to June 1st, I said, are you getting excited for your donut? She goes, I think I want to go to Costco instead. Okay. So I'm thinking, well, we'll just go get a churro, right? We'll share a churro. And so we get to Costco for her birthday, and we're in the food court, and I said, so what do you want? You want a churro? She goes, no, I want to get that man some food. The man, she goes, yeah, he's still out there. I want to get him some food. I said, okay, you know, let's look at the menu. So we look at the menu. She goes, no, Mom, I want to get him, like, a lot of food. Okay. So for her birthday, we went on a little shopping spree in Costco. Now, I highly don't recommend eating 52 chocolate chip granola bars and 50 bags of chips and 50 bottles of Sunny D as a healthy diet. But this is what she thought he needed. So we made our purchase, and we went and we made our delivery. And as we left, my daughter says, oh, what was his name again, Mom? I said, oh, I forgot to ask his name. She goes, that's all right. God knows exactly who he is. Right? And at this point, I mush, because her observation of this man being fully known by God just thrusts me into reality that I am like this man who stands out on the corner. I am also a child of God. I am also deeply known by the Father. And it moved me from a place of being burdened by his needs to finding joy in showing the love of our Creator. Our Creator. So compassion has this ripple effect, and because my daughter's compassion, she was drawn into action. And her action extended the Father's love to another, and in doing so, awakened a piece of my soul to see a little more clearly. It showed me the type of love that Jesus wants us to extend to one another. It's the type that drops off 50 bottles of Sunny D on a hot day. It's extreme. And it is so extreme that if we fully understood just how much we're loved, we'd be asking, what on earth am I going to do with all this love, right? I mean, what was this guy going to do with 50 bottles of Sunny D? You'd hope he'd share it, right? That's a lot of Sunny D. Who needs that much orange juice? When we start to see and care for the hardships and the sorrows of our brothers and sisters, we stop carrying judgment, and we start growing our capacity for forgiveness. And so how does this translate to the people who have harmed us? People who have inflicted suffering on us or our families, who we would say have done the worst of the worst, who have racked up a $10 million debt against you. Luke 6:35 says, but love your enemies and do good to them, and lend to them without expecting anything back. Then your reward will be great. And you will be children of the Most High, because he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. Jesus doesn't just invite us, but actually commands us to love our enemies. And this isn't like an if you feel like it, kuna matata, whatever. No, this is serious, okay? This is the way of the kingdom. And if forgiveness flows from compassion, you have to do the work of identifying the same brokenness that resides within you in another. It starts with saying, I am broken and I need forgiveness, to, ah, my brother's broken and they need forgiveness. So do good to your enemies. Do is an action word. And how do we allow ourselves to be vulnerable enough to move to a place of compassion towards someone who has caused us so much pain and suffering, who owes us much? Well, requires an element of selflessness and tenderness that is only found in the source, Jesus. A few weeks ago, Ken shared the message about the woman caught in adultery. And Jesus literally kneels down beside this woman and extends forgiveness in front of all these people who are accusing her, who are condemning her. And he shows her this gentleness, this tenderness. So the king who forgave a significant sum is like the father who forgives without limits. His forgiveness is bottomless, and Christ embodies the heart of the Father. Adam and Eve, they disobeyed God. They blew it. Noah threw his own grandson into prison, and he blew it. Jacob lied and stole his brother's birthright. He blew it. Moses let his anger get the best of him. He blew it. David had a woman's husband killed so he could have her as his own. He blew it. Solomon turned his heart to false gods. He blew it. And Jonah ran away from God. He blew it. And this is our history. We have blown it over and over and over again, and we are left desperate. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Jesus tells us of a countercultural way of life that we no longer adhere to for an eye, revenge, or worse. Manny, who I introduced earlier, puts it this way. If loving God is the first commandment and loving our neighbor proves our love for God, and if it's easy to love those who love us, then loving our enemies must be the filial badge that identifies us as Abba's children. The Father had so much compassion for our broken ways that he extended us hope through his own son, Jesus Christ. And so clearly, I have been immersed in Manning's book lately, but I have to tell you, as I'm reading this book, I came across this chapter 4, and I am just in tears in the presence of the Trinity and just wanting to stay there a little longer. And so I read it back to back twice. And so I'm going to pick up where we left off and just read you a snippet from there. It says, "Only reckless confidence in a source greater than ourselves can empower us to forgive the wounds inflicted by others. In boundary moments such as these, there is only one place to go. Calvary. Stay there for a long time and watch as Abba's only begotten dies utterly alone in bloody disgrace. Watch as he breathes forgiveness on his torturers at the moment of their greatest cruelty and mercilessness on that lonely hill outside of the city wall of Jerusalem. You will experience the healing power of the dying Lord." Experientially, the inner healing of the heart is seldom a sudden catharsis or an instant liberation from bitterness, anger, resentment, and hatred. More often, it's a gentle growing into oneness with the crucified who has achieved our peace through his blood on the cross. This may take considerable amount of time because the memories are still so vivid and the hurt is still so deep, but it will happen. The crucified Christ is not merely a heroic example of the church. He is the power and the wisdom of God, a living force in his present risenness, transforming our lives and enabling us to extend the hand of reconciliation to our enemies. Understanding triggers the compassion that makes forgiveness possible. You can see why I had to read that a second time, right? See how you would just want to stay there a little longer. Jesus, in his final moments of human life, demonstrates the fullness of compassion. The output of God's compassion in Jesus is advocating for us. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. This is the deep display of the love that he's extending to us. He is forgiving the very people who are responsible for his crucifixion. He sets his deity aside, right? And he suffers alongside bruised and broken humanity. And as he's there suffering, breathing his last breath, he is extending forgiveness. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. We cannot forgive on our own strength. Okay? we must look to this parable in the life of Christ to know that we have received an unfathomable amount of forgiveness so that we may be equipped and able to forgive all these micro offenses against us. We need the compassion and the forgiveness of the Father so that our hearts are ripe and ready to extend grace, mercy, and compassion to those who have offended us. And for some of us, the transforming work of God that he's doing in us is inviting us to ask someone for forgiveness. For some of us, it's to extend forgiveness. And for some of us, it's to receive and accept the forgiveness that Christ has already made available to us. Okay? For some of us, we don't even know where to start. And we need to ask for some help because we're sitting there with our power drill taking apart a playhouse. Okay? I know I had to do this week. I had, before I could give this message, I actually had to call a friend and sit with her and ask her for some forgiveness. It's hard work. It's good work. So in a world that tells us to forgive and forget, I want to encourage you guys to just completely take that phrase out of your vocabulary. And I would encourage you to first remember. Remember what God did for you. Remember what Christ did for you. So remember and then forgive. Allow the unfailing and bottomless love of the Father to move you towards loving others. Okay? Let's not sit in our woodpile. Let's bring our wounds to the Father so that he can tend to them. And he will. He will tend to them. I've asked my friend Carol to come up this morning. Carol is the spiritual director that comes in and leads our pastoral and office staff in practices that draw us near to the Father. So I've asked her to come up and put some life to this call to forgive. And so as she leads us this morning, I encourage you to just soak in the space with the Trinity and allow the Father to tend to your heart for whatever needs tending to. And then afterwards, she'll invite you to do a worship response with us.
Good morning. I almost feel undone. Thank you. That's not a good way to begin this. But anyway. So I'd like to guide you just through a prayerful meditation around forgiveness. And as we begin, I just ask that if you have anything in your lap, that you would just set it down and get yourself comfortable, relax a little bit into your chair, feet on the floor, so that you can relax and participate and listen as we go into this prayer together. So let me pray for us as we begin. Father, give us a heart that is open and present, expectant and willing to hear you speak into our lives through this time of reflection. Amen. As we go through this, you may choose to close your eyes and imagine the scene as I describe it, or we're putting an image up on the screens that you can focus on that if that makes that easier for you to enter into this theme. And when you're looking at the picture or closing your eyes and imagining, use all of your senses. Think about what must this have felt like? What do you hear? What do you smell? What do you notice? So be aware of what's going on in and around you as we imagine ourselves in this scene. Watch Jesus as he comes into the temple courtyard. It's early in the morning. He's been on the Mount of Olives praying. As you watch him, as you see him coming, what do you notice about him? What is his facial expression like? What is his body language like? How do you see him as he comes? Notice how he sits down with those who are gathered in the courtyard. And he begins to speak to them. Listen. What does his voice sound like? Think about the times you've heard his voice. What does it sound like now as he's sitting and he begins to teach? The experts in the law and the Pharisees interrupt Jesus. They forcefully bring a woman before him, and there's a crowd following him. As they bring her, with violence to Jesus, making her stand in front of him and all of these people. This woman, they tell Jesus, was caught in the act of adultery. Let this statement sink in. This woman was caught in the act of adultery. Reflect on the amount of vigilance and self-righteousness needed to catch another person in sin. Scripture tells us that they used their religious tradition, the law, against this woman in order to trap Jesus. Think for a moment what kind of hearts these people had as they brought this woman to Jesus. You're watching all of this unfold. Where are you? Are you sitting on the stairs of the courtyard where you were when Jesus was speaking and teaching? Are you in the crowd that is bringing the woman to Jesus? What are you feeling right now? What is happening in your body? If you're in the crowd with the Pharisees, feel the rock that you have in your hand. You should all have been given a rock. Notice it. Feel it. Think about what you're intending to do with it. What does this feel like in your own body? Focus on the woman. For the next few minutes, ask God to show you the person in your life who has caused you to feel righteous, to feel judgment. Who is the person who's challenging your expertise, who's challenging your power, who's challenging your authority, who may be challenging your tradition, your understanding of who God is, who's challenging your belief system, whether it be political or religious? And maybe they just challenge the way that you live your life by the way they live theirs. See that person clearly in your mind. Speak their name quietly to yourself. You are bringing this person before Jesus, and you're demanding that he takes up your grievance. You are a faithful person. You are a follower. Therefore, Jesus, you need to act. Take a moment to speak to Jesus about who this person is and what you believe they have done that has wronged you. If you are a part of the crowd that has been listening to Jesus speak before the woman was brought before him, Reflect on what it's like to be present and silent. Take a moment just to notice what it feels like to be silent as the scene is unfolding. You watch Jesus. He bends down. He stoops and he writes on the ground. What does that feel like? You've brought this person before him. You've pleaded your case. You've asked him to intervene. And he doesn't respond. He stoops down. He stands and he speaks to you. If you are guiltless, you may throw your stone at the person. And he stoops down again. How are you feeling? What goes through your mind? If I am guiltless, I can throw my stone at this person. Are you able to leave this person with Jesus? Are you able to drop your rock? If you are a silent observer, consider the weight of your rock of silence. If you drop your rock, when you turn away, you will hear Jesus speak to this person that you brought before him. Where is the person who has condemned you? And Jesus, and the person says, they have left. Hear Jesus say, I don't condemn you either. Go and live, knowing you are forgiven. Live your life in God's shalom. If you have encountered the forgiveness of Jesus in your own life, and you can extend forgiveness to the person that you have brought before him, I invite you for the next few moments just to bring your rock and place it in one of these baskets up front. If you need more time to reflect on this, to reflect on what this rock means, to reflect on the weight of silence, what that might mean, to reflect on what it means to extend forgiveness to another, to reflect on how easy it is for us to come up with a judgment against a person, and how often we ask Jesus to respond for us. But Jesus has extended his forgiveness totally unconditionally, and he invites us to do the same. So I just invite you, bring your rock or continue to hold it as you need to continue this conversation with Jesus.